Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, well, a little bit of everything, actually, just like this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 17th of November. Good as always to have you along. Everybody, you know that saying, all politics is local? Well, submitted for your approval, this corporate variant. All business depends on what kind of company you are. That's relevant today because for all of the wailing and gnashing of teeth about the supply chain mishigas going on right now, for a certain kind of company in this economy, honestly, it's supply chain crisis? What supply chain crisis? That was the message from big box retailers this week. Walmart and Target and Home Depot all told investors they've got plenty of inventory, thank you very much, to get them through the holidays. But with the logjam at the ports and the shortage of truck drivers and all the rest that we have been telling you about, how exactly did they pull that off? Marketplace's Matt Levin gets us going.
You know those local news reports you see every Black Friday of shoppers engaged in hand-to-hand combat over that last power saw at Home Depot? Don't blame that on broken supply chains this year.
I wouldn't expect to see any glaring shortages of product.
Liz Suzuki is a retail analyst with Bank of America. She says big box retailers learned a lesson from Black Friday 2020, when they actually wanted fewer customers in store and more online.
They did pre-buy or just bought, you know, 1 or 2 months before they normally would have. So then again, they did that for spring. They took that into this year's holiday season as well.
Beyond being well prepared, big box retailers get VIP treatment from freight carriers simply because they're big, says Jason Miller, a professor at Michigan State University.
They're going to get prioritized by the ocean carriers. And they're going to get preferential treatment on the inland transportation side from the railroads as well as from trucking companies, given the size and scale.
Miller says the hype around retailers chartering their own cargo ships is overblown, but many are finding novel ways around those backed up ports, especially for expensive items. Terry Esper is a professor of logistics at Ohio State.
Companies like a Walmart, for example, that sells a ton of technology, I would assume that they probably leverage their air cargo capabilities to be able to, you know, essentially fly over, pun intended, the congestion on the West Coast.
That's an option most small businesses can't afford. Part of the reason many big box retailers have picked up market share this year. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
President Biden's sales tour for the $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan he signed into law on Monday took him to Detroit today and one of GM's electric vehicle plants there. The new law, which includes $7.5 billion, by the way, to add more EV charging infrastructure around the country, because if you don't have that, those EVs become a lot less attractive, right? Marketplace's Samantha Fields looks at what is needed and who is actually doing the work of building out that new piece of America's infrastructure.
When Andrew Mosman decided to take his Tesla on a road trip from Los Angeles to a bunch of national parks in Utah a couple of years ago, he wasn't worried about being able to get from LA to Utah on the highway. But he was worried about finding charging stations in more remote areas between national parks.
I decided to try to go from hotel to hotel and only stay at places that had Tesla chargers. That worked until it didn't work.
When he got to his second hotel, the only two EV chargers were already being used. He was able to find just enough power to get through to the next day, but it was a little dicey. There are still a lot of places around the country where EV chargers are hard to find, but a growing number of companies, from car makers to startups, are building more of them all the time.
We have stations in 46 states, and we feature ultra-fast charging, which is capable of recharging a car at 20 miles of range per minute.
Matthew Nelson is with Electrify America, and he says any electric car can use its stations. Teslas, which have their own unique kind of plug, and the vast majority of EVs in the U.S., which have more standard combined charging system plugs. Building new charging stations, Nelson says, involves a lot of players. For instance, big chains like Target or Walmart will often lease space in parking lots.
And then we can't build the station unless it can be connected to the power grid. And so we reach out to the utilities, and the utilities design the service, and then we build the station.
Nationwide, there are just under 50,000 public EV charging stations. Biden's goal for 2030, 500,000. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stocks go down too, you know, but honestly, just a little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Netflix and chill? Yeah, sure, fine, whatever. But Netflix and chill and viewer data? Oh, now that's hot. The streaming company has been notoriously hush-hush about how shows and movies do on its platform, but that ends now. Kinda. Company's going to be publishing viewing hours for its 10 most viewed shows and movies every week. So Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why the company has been so secretive about that all-important data, and why it's decided to start sharing some of it now.
If you grew up in the era of broadcast TV, you're used to ratings. But the rating system was created for one big reason that just doesn't apply to Netflix.
Remember that Netflix doesn't sell advertising.
Tim Hanlon at the Vertair Group says there wasn't a reason for Netflix to be transparent about its numbers until those numbers became too good to ignore. The platform has more than 200 million subscribers. Hulu, by comparison, has about 40 million. And Michael Smith, a professor of information technology and marketing at Carnegie Mellon University, says many shows and movies on Netflix's top 10 list are originals.
For a long time, we looked at them just as a platform, that they're reliant on the other content creators for their success. So I think it's a little bit of flexing.
This flexing is mostly for viewers, a PR play that says only Netflix has what you want to watch. It's also for content creators to show the potential of signing a deal with the platform. And it's flexing for other platforms, taunting them, like, catch me if you can.
It's going to put pressure on the other streaming platforms to do the same, and Netflix knows that they're going to look better.
Becoming the first streaming platform to publish this data has other benefits. Paul Erickson is an analyst at Parks Associates.
Really, it's a chance for Netflix to set the standards and dialogue before the industry does or their competitors do.
And he thinks eventually Netflix's competitors will have to show their cards too. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This economy does not work the same for everybody. Not in what kinds of jobs people get, not in education, not in opportunity, and not in food. There's a new book out called How the Other Half Eats, The Untold Story of Food and Inequality in America by Dr. Priya Fielding Singh. She's at the University of Utah. And she followed four moms, really, across the wealth spectrum about their relationship with food and income and how that affected their families. The first thing I asked her was how a family's income does affect its diet.
One thing that I found was that, you know, the context within which mothers were raising their children really differently impacted whether they were able to feed their kids the way that they wanted. For low-income moms who were raising their kids in contexts of poverty, you know, being able to make ends meet really depended on saying no to kids. And in this world of no, you know, food was one of the few means that moms had to show their kids that they not only could get them what they needed, but also some of what they wanted. And that was extremely emotionally nourishing for children. And it also delivered to moms a sense that they were competent and caring parents to their children.
Yeah. There is one of the lower income moms that you spoke to. She says, basically, letting my kids have this, even though it might not be good for them, lets me keep going in a way, right? And lets me keep parenting,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think, you know, one of the big things that I'm trying to communicate in the book is that food is a really emotional thing. It's kind of core to what it is to be a mother, to be able to feed and nourish your kids. And so while from a public health standpoint, some of those foods aren't ideal, you know, if you think about being able to emotionally and psychologically nourish your child and feel okay as a mom, those foods actually make perfect sense.
As we look at income inequality and the nutritional gap in this country, I wonder, and this is a little bit sideways of a question, but I wonder what you hope people get out of this book, because, look, you're a serious academic and you've spent years of your life on this research, and yes, some large number of people are going to hear this, but there's the challenge of making change, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I have hopes for a number of things, but one big thing that I'd like people to take away from our conversation, from the book more broadly, is that we need to move the conversation beyond food access and food deserts. You know, we are not going to work our way out of this problem simply by opening supermarkets in food deserts. We're also not going to fix the problem simply by increasing the amount of federal food assistance that we give to families. Like, as you know, that, you know, SNAP was increased 27% this year, which is the largest historic increase. It's tremendous. It's important. It's not going to fix the overall problem because we have these underlying inequalities that are really at the root of this issue.
So at the end of your research, you gave each family $300 and you wanted them to document how they spent it. And I'm curious as to what you learned out of that.
So the two low-income mothers who I spent time with, Naya and Dana, the first thing that they both did with the $300 was they took $200 of it and split it between their two daughters. They just gave it to their kids and told them to spend it however they wanted. And they did. All their kids had such a great time. They went to the mall. They got Panda Express. They got new clothes.
Wow.
And I was really struck by this. You know, I think as someone who often engages in discussions of public health, the consensus is, okay, if you give families money, they should or will spend it on healthy food. That completely misses the broader context within which they're raising their kids.
Right.
You know, for these low-income moms, it didn't make sense to go and buy a bunch of kale and make a salad for their kids. Rather, what made sense
guaranteed
was
to make
to
their
give
kids
their
miserable, by the way. I'm just saying.
Exactly. They weren't going to use that money to make their kids miserable and to quite honestly probably make themselves miserable by trying to force their kids to eat those foods. Rather, you know, it made a lot of sense for them to put that money toward their kids' preferences. So that was one thing that really struck me and I think may be surprising for some folks to hear.
It's a book called How the Other Half Eats, The Untold Story of Food and Inequality in America. Dr. Priya Fielding Singh wrote it. She's at the University of Utah. Dr. Fielding Singh, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up.
And we think our way is all the right way.
Except, you know, for all the other ways, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 211 today, about 0.5%, 35,931. The NASDAQ off 52 points, about 0.3%, 15,921 at the end there. S&P 500 dipped 12 points, 0.2%, 46 and 88. Heard from Smith Fields about nationwide EV charging stations. Thus, some EV stocks. Lucid Motors down 5.3% today. Tesla up 3.2%. EVgo that makes chargers brightened to 2.6%. Heard from Kristen Schwab that Netflix is releasing some viewership data for its top 10 most watched shows and films. Netflix tuned up 0.6% today. Streaming competitor of the Walt Disney Company sank 0.9%. Viacom CBS down 0.1% while I'm at it. Bond prices, while they were up, thanks for, you know, asking, because I know you're curious. The yield on the 10-year Tino. No, I know you're not, actually. Yield on the 10-year down to 1.58%. The bond market matters, you guys. We're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So, we talked about retail sales yesterday, up even in the face of all that inflation out there. Consumers making the choice to buy. Retailers, though, are making choices, too, in this inflationary moment we're having. Most specifically, what to do about their rising costs, and even more particularly, what to do about their imported products and ingredients and how much more expensive they're getting. I mean, sure, they could just jack up prices and make their customers eat the cost, right? But a lot of small business owners are trying to do everything they can to not do that. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that one.
The cost of importing some of the olive oils and vinegars on sale at the Minneapolis store Vinaigrette has gone up a lot lately. And so later this month, owner Sarah Piepenberg is planning to raise some of her prices anywhere from 10 to 30%. It's not something she wants to have to do again.
Like, at what point is my olive oil or my vinegar going to be cost prohibitive to my customer base? Because I think it already has, to a certain degree.
That is the situation small businesses across the country are trying to avoid. Instead of raising their prices, they're looking to other ways to protect their margins. For one Brooklyn-based importer, you might say the solution is less can be more.
You may look at something that you did before and say, well, this is not worth it.
Pat Whalen handles imports for Sahadi's, a food importer that's both a retailer and a wholesaler. At the company's retail store, that means not being open as many hours a day.
By the time you staff the store and by the time you run it and by the time you open and the little stuff, you realize that, like, well, for the first 2 hours, you're losing money. Do we really need to be there at this time?
The store is also selling fewer prepared dishes at the deli and stocking fewer items on its shelves. Cheeses, varieties of blackberry jam, types of almonds.
Does it matter to you whether the sliced almond has a brown rim on it or a white rim on it? Probably not.
While Sahadi's is cutting back, the bakery equipment supplier TMB Baking near San Francisco is doing the opposite.
What we're actually trying to do is increase our purchases.
Greg Warwick is the CEO.
Particularly things like spiral mixers and other things that are used in the bread baking industry.
The hope, Warwick says, is that by ordering more products, the company can negotiate lower prices with its suppliers. The company is also working to control the cost of shipping by cramming shipping containers full of more equipment.
We're creating them in a way that we can stack them higher into the container using every nook and cranny for different sizes and types of equipment.
Warwick says the company is leasing an additional warehouse to store all of that extra inventory. It also just bought a new truck to help reduce the cost of delivering items. Warwick says these are expensive decisions, so they're risky.
But we can be willing to take that risk just to keep our costs under control and our prices under reasonable increases to our customers as much as we're able to.
At Minneapolis olive oil and vinegar store Vinaigrette, owner Sarah Piepenberg has been trying to solve some of her supply chain challenges on her own. She always ships less than a truckload of merchandise, but she says it's hard for her to even get the attention of the LTL carrier companies that provide that kind of service.
And even if the LTL carrier can actually pick it up, do they have a driver to get it from point A to point B?
So twice now, she says, she and her husband have driven to Chicago to pick up orders themselves.
And the thing is like we have a minivan. I'm putting 5,000 pounds on my minivan and driving for 6 hours.
Piepenberg says she traded in her old minivan for a newer one that can handle the weight of the goods better. Now she's in the market for a flatbed trailer. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Another wildfire season is mercifully winding down in much of the American West as cold weather moves in. But you know what happens now, right? More fires. Fire officials say this is a good time to be thinking about setting controlled burns, sometimes called prescribed fires, to burn off unwanted dead trees and underbrush that, left to grow, will just fuel bigger wildfires when the weather gets hotter and drier, as it surely will. Madeline Beck from the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
I'm on a dirt road in the Albion Mountains of southern Idaho, and I'm with Stacy Tyler, who helps plan prescribed burns for the Forest Service. She points to an area slated for fire, a large area.
This one's a couple thousand acres. The one just down the hill is only a couple hundred acres.
That's nearly 3.5 square miles altogether. Tyler says the area likely hasn't burned in 100 years, give or take. Federal agencies used to try to put out all fires to reduce risks to people. But now, unburned forests, dried out by warming weather, are fueling unprecedented extreme blazes. Fires lit now in cool, controlled conditions could dampen more destructive ones later on. And prescribed burns in this location can reduce overgrown vegetation that's crowding out the iconic aspen tree.
Without repeated disturbance, meaning most likely fire events, the aspen are eventually going to go away.
Tyler says trees in that area aren't worth much to timber companies, so the Forest Service plans to burn most of it. That gives aspen space to regrow and provides better habitat for species like mule deer. But ranchers are also grazing cattle on that land, and there's a history of distrust between federal agencies and ranchers in the region. Tom Otley ranches near the planned burn area in Idaho. I called him when he was out working with some of his 500 head of cattle.
I'm going to cut out here in just a sec. I got to hit these cows.
He says it can be tough to find middle ground sometimes.
We learn from experience here, and we think our way is all the right way. Then you got the guys that are in the books, and this is what the book says, and then those two can't hit together. They just battle.
Otley was one of many people who sat down with the Forest Service and other stakeholders to talk about the planned burns.
Initial thing for us was a fire. No way we can't have a fire. There's just no way we can have a fire because we'll be off for 3 years.
That is 3 years when their cattle won't be able to graze there. He was also concerned about fires escaping. Over the years, several studies have found only around 1 to 2% of managed forest fires escape and threaten surrounding areas. But Otley had his reservations until he attended a meeting where he says someone from the Forest Service both listened and explained the science well.
I felt when I came out of there that they were trying to resolve both sides of the situation. And I think they do need to do some management of some sort to reduce fuels.
They didn't agree on everything, he says, but found enough common ground to move forward. A 2006 Forest Service study found that about 80% of people are actually okay with prescribed burns, but groups wary of the federal government or those who've been near burns that escaped a prescribed area before will likely want to talk through their concerns. That's something the new Forest Service Chief Randy Moore says the agency plans to do.
We have to spend some of our effort, our energy, and time talking about fuel treatments.
He wants more prescribed burns, too. A lot more.
Our goal is to increase prescribed burning threefold, if not even more.
Moore paused all prescribed burns this summer, though, citing strained firefighting resources and extremely dry conditions. A group of fire and forest ecologists argue that was the wrong call, since it didn't allow fires to burn when local areas had good conditions. Regardless, there is extensive scientific research that says we need more prescribed burns now. Without them, we're expected to face larger, hotter, more extreme wildfires all around the West. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. You know, one makes too big a deal of daily oil price moves at one's peril, but hey, it's my show. I'm going to roll the dice. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate dropped below $80 a barrel today, $78.36 off 3%. A gallon of gas, meanwhile, on average nationwide, still about $3.40. All right, here's your moment of economic context on the way out. History Matters edition is what this one is. 152 years ago today, what happened? Any guesses? Well, if you said the Suez Canal opened, you go straight to the head of the class. Good on you. Most of us, of course, know the canal for the Ever Given, the container ship that got sideways for a week or so this past spring. Might I, however, suggest another little thing called globalization might be relevant? Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.